Well, are finicky cats born or do we create them? Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And she'll talk about what makes pets, especially cats, finicky and how you can get them to eat better. And of course, we'll take your calls. I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Well, let's talk about these finicky cats.
Yeah, you know, the old question is, do we make them or are they born that way? And really, in reality, it's probably both. There's a lot of genetics and evolution involved with cats and their pickiness when they want to eat. And we used to think that aroma, the smell of the food, the taste of the food, and the texture were probably the big things that would drive cats to want to eat certain foods. And it still is true. Cats that are not exposed to a wide variety of things early in life, like in the first 6 months of their life, will become very finicky cats later in life. And so I always counsel my new kitty owners to, you know, feed them different sizes and shapes of food, canned food, dry food, anything, like different textures of things, because there will be a time at the pet's life where we may need to put them on a canned food diet for some reason. And so it's really helpful to be able to have a cat that is more open to variety. But there was some research report that was just done recently that looked at, what drives a cat to pick certain foods. And what we actually found is that it was the nutrition or the makeup of the food that actually drove a cat to eat it. And they prefer a protein to fat ratio of one part protein to 0.4 parts of fat. So calorie-wise, that's about, you know, for every calorie of protein is equal to about a calorie of fat. So they really like a high protein, fairly high fat diet. And, the carbohydrate-laced diets and so on that we have, although many cats will eat them, it's kind of like junk food for cats. Like I have a cat that just loves cat treats, and they tend to be rather high in carbs, and the cat will like them. But I kind of look at that as just kind of a, you know, oh, you know, she's bored, she wants something, and it may, you know, it just, you know, just like us eating junk food. But when they gave cats a variety of different foods, you know, rabbit and chicken and even orange flavored cat foods, if they adjusted that protein to fat ratio, the cats would go for the orange scented and orange flavored food if it had the right protein and fat levels. So, be really watching. And so when we start talking about putting cats on diets that are called Katkins diets, the high protein, high fat moderate to high fat diet, then that is probably why the cats, you know, really will do well on those foods and maintain their lean body mass and like them better. So, try to stay with the higher protein foods if you can.
All right. That makes good sense to me. We have Jeff online from Milwaukee. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just curious if it's safe or a good idea to have cats on or occasional dairy milk, cow's milk?
Yeah, it really depends on the cat. Some cats, just like some people, are very lactose intolerant, and then you would have to deal with the mess afterwards. And so it can upset their intestinal tract. Some people find that just, you know, if they get a lap or two of milk, the cat does fine. We just don't want cats to become food fixated, where they will only drink milk and they don't want anything else. So as long as it's an occasional treat, it doesn't upset their gastrointestinal tract, I have no problems at all with it. We want to make sure that cats are getting about 90% of their diet from a well-balanced food. And then that 10% is things that you could use, like the treats that I give my cats, or like the little bit of milk that you may be giving your cats once in a while. So I don't look at it as a problem if the cat tolerates it.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. How do you tell if a cat is sick or just finicky?
Oh, well, that is a really good question because, you know, if you've got a cat that is, you know, maybe not drinking as much, and that's where it's important to be able to monitor how much water they're taking in, kind of know how much is in the water bowl when you fill it up. If they're not grooming themselves, that's a sure sign that they may not be feeling well. So their coat may look a little rough, kind of like us when we get sick. We lay around and our hair is a mess and we don't care what we look like. If they're not socially interactive with you, so if you've got this cat that just doesn't like the food and is bugging you and meowing and rubbing against you and is like, come on, give me something that I really like, that's probably just a finicky cat. But if they're, you know, really just not themselves, then it may be something more. And, you know, if we can't let cats starve to death either, and that's a big problem for cats, is that they break down, they have to make what are called lipoproteins. And it uses the liver a lot. And if they aren't taking in food, they'll start breaking down their body fat as a source of energy. And it gets kind of plugged up in the liver and it causes a condition called hepatic lipidosis or fatty liver disease. And without care, usually in a critical care unit, these cats won't make it. And so wow. We always want to make sure that cats are eating, that they have food available. If you've got a cat that's off food for 24 hours, By all means, that's the time to say we better get them in and have them looked at, or sooner if there's other symptoms going along with it.
You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's hear from Jerry next in Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, guys. Great show.
Thank you.
We have a little cat we rescued from the Humane Society a little over a year ago. And I mean, she loves science, diet, harder control food. She also likes a little bit of hairball control science diet. So we tried a few different types of items, and she won't eat them at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what brands of food you suggest are is actually science diet better than Iams, or does she just like the flavor better?
It's probably just flavor and texture. A lot of the dental diets that are on the market have a lot of fat on the outside of the pellets that you're feeding, and they're more fibrous on the inside. And so from the cat's point of view, they're going to be getting that food in their mouth and tasting that kind of fatty exterior much faster than they would with other types of food. And so I see a lot of cats just really, really like these dental diets that are mechanically going to be bigger, so they have to chew the food to be able to swallow it. And they make that outer surface so that the tooth can penetrate it and so the food doesn't shatter. And then the inside is very fibrous to help squeegee the teeth clean. So that may be why your cat really likes that particular type of diet. I am not brand loyal when it comes to recommending a certain brand of pet food. I think the things that you need to be looking for are, number one, is it a company that does feeding trials? Do they go through what's called AFCO, which stands for the American Association of Feed Control Officials Feeding Trials? I want to see that food actually fed to pets to make sure that it's going to be okay. There are a number of manufacturers out there that formulate their food to meet AFCO standards, and that's exactly what it'll say on the bag, and that just means that they followed a recipe, and a lot can happen to a recipe. I mean, I can make something, and boy, Martha Stewart can make it, and it looks beautiful, and I make it, and it doesn't turn out as well. What did I do wrong? You know, the same thing can happen with pet food, is that sometimes heat processing or storage or something may cause some changes in that formulation. And so how are you going to know it unless it starts showing up as a problem in cats? And I would rather see it be found out before it gets on the shelves for everybody else to have their cats eating it. The other thing that I like to see is that the company is actually making their own food. There are many companies out there that have their logo, have their label, but they are making it at multiple different plants around the country. And so there's less regulation from the company's point of view, because they're not there watching over how these other companies are making the food for them, yet they still put their label on it. And that is some of the big foods that are being advertised out there right now actually do that. I also like to see a company that has a veterinary nutritionist on staff, somebody that is there that is a boarded veterinarian in nutrition that is able to answer your questions or your veterinarian's questions. And you'd be surprised how many companies don't have a veterinarian on staff. And so those are kind of my three guidelines that I like to go by. And then I like to see a food that's going to meet the cat's needs. One, do they like it? Two, does it meet their health needs, whether it be their age, kitten versus an older cat, or whether they need to be on a therapeutic diet for a kidney disease, a liver disease, heart disease, whatever it may happen that they may have going on, where they may need to be on a therapeutic diet. And then something that is easy for you to be able to obtain as well, because we don't want you to be running out and having to switch to something else because you get it at some oddball place that's closed, you know, on days that you may need it. So there's that convenience factor as well. So sorry, I am not going to say one way or the other, but if your cat is doing well, I'm very happy with the Science Diet Dental Diet. I think that it does a phenomenal job of keeping cats' teeth clean, and it has the Veterinary Oral Health Council's seal of approval on it for making sure that it keeps plaque and tartar under control.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jerry. Michelle in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Dr. Sawchuk and Larry. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm having some behavioral issues with my two cats, actually. They're both sisters, and they're about 4.5 years old. They were found, and I think they had a traumatic start to life because they've always been a little skittish. But what's really developed between the two of them is an animosity. They don't like being with each other so much anymore. Especially, they're indoor cats, but at night times with the doors open, or with the windows open in the summertime, for example, if a cat comes by outside, they'll attack each other. And I think over time, that's led to a lot of stress in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And this has showed up in some ways with one of them spraying.
Okay.
Especially on like soft surfaces, including my furniture. I've gone through a couple of rounds of chairs, and it's just gotten very, very frustrating. I've been to the vet. Initially, there were crystals in the bladder of one of them, so that one went through surgery, and that actually created more tension when she came home in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan is I have an adult son who's in his last year of school who can take a cat. And you do know him. So one of those cats, I think, is about to head out to the Twin Cities.
Okay.
And I want to make sure, A, that the transition is as successful as possible. So I'm driving about 4 hours with this cat, hopefully soon.
Okay.
B, I want to make sure that once he has her, she's not going to, even in a household without another cat there, be tempted to do the same, to start, you know, peeing inappropriately. Now,
right.
She's going to be going from like a 1,300 square foot home to, you know, a 2-bedroom apartment.
Mm-hmm.
My son's in too. So I'm just concerned about all those things. I would love any tips you have to share.
Oh, my goodness. You have brought up so many good topics here that I could probably spend the rest of the show talking about. You know, you brought up the fact that they were two kitties adopted together, and because they, even though they may be siblings, doesn't mean that they're going to get along the rest of their life together. And remember that critical socialization time for cats, to have them be less skittish and very socially adaptable to new situations, we need to get them exposed to things as early as less than 7 weeks of age. From 2 to 7 weeks of age is when they need to be exposed to all that stuff. And so, and you know, if they were strays outside and maybe trusted people because, hey, people feed us, but maybe I don't want to get picked up, or I'm going to be a little nervous around people. Mm-hmm. So just remember that if you're ever thinking about getting another cat. There's a really interesting study done out of, I believe it was Georgia, looking at two cat households, and they looked at all the different permutations male-male, male-female, and female-female, and they found that the best combination was two males, that there tend to be, they groomed each other, they slept together, they tended to be better, like, best buddies. Male-female, it was kind of a crapshoot. It kind of depended on different things, the size of the environment and, you know, other things, in the cat's early social skills that they developed and so on. Female-female situations, they would coexist, but not necessarily like each other that much. Now, I know there's people that are going to say, I have two female cats and they get along great. And there are going to be cats that are out there that are like that. But, you know, just realize that if you are going to be getting two cats, you may want to look at either getting two boys or a boy and a girl rather than two girls, because it may not always work out. What you described with the redirected aggression, the cat seeing another cat outside the window because you've got the windows open, they can see them, hear them, smell them, created a lot of stress. And it's kind of like if you have a bad day at work and you come home from work and your spouse says something to you that maybe you take the wrong way, and what do? You chew your spouse's head off because you had a bad day at work, and you take it off out on somebody else. That's kind of what redirected aggression is on the cat. They're upset because they're seeing another cat. This other cat walks up to them that's living in the house with them, and they turn around and attack that cat. And that can be a long-lasting relationship breaker for kitties as well. And so that would be the case where I would be making sure that if they are that sensitive to other cats, especially the cat that's going to be going up to Minneapolis or the Twin Cities, making sure that the windows are kept shut, that if there are stray cats outside, they may want to put up some blinds or something that doesn't allow the cat to be able to see them, because that could trigger spraying in the house if they're upset with seeing other cats outside. I would also be looking at things that you could do for moving the cat is, you know, having a room in your son's apartment set up with things that smell like home, a scratching post, litter box, food bowls, you know, a blanket that maybe they've laid on. So everything, it's like, wow, this may be a different space, but everything smells like home. Let the cat get used to that one room before letting them expand their territory. Once you start letting them out and roaming around a little bit more, you're going to want to make sure that you have at least two litter boxes, because you've got one cat. Remember the rule, a litter box for every cat plus one. And then making sure that your son is keeping it very, very clean, preferably uncovered, so that he can see it and the cat doesn't feel trapped, especially if they're one of the nervous ones with, you know, maybe another cat may sneak up on me. And definitely plug in some feel away. It's that pheromone that is in a little atomizer that may help your cat feel a little more, the cat feel a little more comfortable in the new environment. And I would make sure that they get the kitty into a veterinarian as soon as possible so that they can get a good thorough health check to make sure that there isn't any problems. And other than that, it's going to be keep our fingers crossed.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health, zeroed in a little on finicky cats, but we'll talk cats and dogs with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And callers online, let's go back to the phones. Carolyn in Oshkosh is next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could give a little bit of information to your listeners, well, and myself, about taurine and cat food. I noticed there was taurine. We adopted a cat. I noticed there was taurine listed right on the front of the package, the snack package, and I've been drinking that in my energy drink. So yeah. I called the place down the road. They have a pet resort and a pet shop. They know Caesar Milan and all that. But they said that there's a concentration, high concentration of taurine in mice heads. They did some sort of study, and that's why, you know, cats go after mice. They need that taurine.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they get some disease, and I can't remember what it is.
Well, taurine is an amino acid, and cats are unique in that they need it in a preformed state. Other beings, like dogs and humans, are able to take other amino acids, and actually the body can turn them into taurine. And so we can take it in. That's why we are able to eat a vegetarian diet and not actually, you know, because we can take a different amino acids and turn them into taurine. But cats can't. And so that's why they need to be on, have meat in their diet. Whether it's high in mouse heads or not, I have no idea. All I know is that mice are a pretty complete and balanced diet if you can get past the gross out factor and the fact that they carry a lot of parasites that can parasitize your cat. So I would not be recommending that you that have that as your cat's only diet. But you do need to make sure that there is adequate taurine in the food. And that's one of the issues that we've been seeing in some pet foods that have been recently recalled. And that they follow a recipe and they say, yes, we've got enough taurine in it, but then it's heat processed. And when they heat it up to put it in the can, the taurine level gets denatured and now it's not available to the cat. And now they're taurine deficient. What happens, probably the two big things with taurine deficiency in cats, number one is they get a condition called dilated cardiomyopathy. The heart has a very high need for taurine levels. And so without it, the heart will start to fail. And it is something that is reversible if you diagnose it before they die of heart failure. But you can supplement them with taurine and they will, their heart will get better. And that's a very specific type of heart disease for cats. There are other types of cardiomyopathy that cats get that are not going to be taurine responsive. The other area that they need a lot of taurine is also the retina. And without that, they can develop blindness. And I had an entire barn cat population when I was in private practice where they said the cats are not doing well. We don't know why. And it turns out they were feeding them dog food, which is not supplemented with taurine. So the cats were not getting enough taurine and they all went blind. And that was irreversible. So that's, you know, just cats are not dogs and you can't feed cats dog food. The odd bite of dog food isn't going to cause them a problem. If it's just like a snack where they're stealing something, but you want to make sure that you're feeding a food with adequate levels of taurine in it.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Carolyn. Willem and Colfax, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We're going to adopt a cat that has, he was found along the river and in Menominee, and he was in pretty bad shape. I guess they had to put him on ice and give him IVs and all that sort of stuff, and he was very skinny. Now he's recovering, but they think he has hyperthyroidism, and I wonder if that hyper. We've had two other cats with hyperthyroidism, so I'm familiar with the treatment. But I'm wondering, does the condition ever reverse or get better as his health improves?
No, probably not. When cats develop hyperthyroidism, it's usually because they, as an aged cat, they get a nodule on one or both of the thyroid glands that secretes too much thyroid hormone. And so it's not something that is going to get better on their own. And so you're usually looking at either using a medication called methimazole, either in an oral tablet or a gel that is a biogel that goes on the inside of the ear. Radioactive iodine therapy is another very commonly used treatment for it. There's a diet out on the market now called YD that Hills makes that's an iodine-restricted diet. They can eat that and only that. They don't get any other treats, any other food. And so if you've got other cats in the household, it's a very difficult diet to be able to introduce so that only they get it. And then there's the old-fashioned way of doing surgery, but that is, we have not done surgery on these cats for probably a good 25 plus years since we've got all these other medications and treatment modalities out there. So, you know, he may have been by the river because he was hyperthyroid and not feeling well and got dehydrated and overheated and so on. And it's unfortunate, but hopefully he's in good hands now. And hopefully you'll adopt him and help him out, because they can lead a completely normal life for many years after treatment.
There we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Willem. Susan and Wanakee, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have two rescued male Shih Tzus, and their ages are 7 and 9, and they're very well house trained. And I'm considering adopting another one. The dog was house trained. It's 14 years old. However, the owner, somewhat unable to let them out as regularly as she could, started, due to a neighbor's help, training the dog on pee pads.
Mm-hmm.
So for the last 1 to 2 years, this dog has been using a pee pad. If I adopt this dog, who also is unfortunately deaf, do you think there's going to be a major problem in reversing that? And do you think in the process that that dog will be affecting my house-trained dog?
Probably. If the dog was used to going outside in its previous life, because dogs learn surface preference very early in life, kind of like us. I mean, we like a porcelain throne with a door that locks, and dogs learn that grass under my feet or gravel under my feet equals a toilet area. You can train a dog to, you know, select another surface with a lot of positive reinforcement and rewards and so on, and that's how they probably train the dog to use the piddle pads. There's nothing special about them. They're just absorbent, and you train the dog, you go there, and great things happen. So what I would be recommending is that you treat this dog just like it was a puppy. 100% of your attention's on the dog. If they show any inclination to needing to eliminate, you take them outside. Lots of, even though they're deaf, verbal praise, because they're probably seeing your facial expressions and so on, because that's so important. But also follow up with a little food treat or something so they know that, boy, going to the bathroom outside is the best thing in the whole world. And I think that, it, you know, even though it's an older dog, you can teach them a new trick, or maybe a not so new trick, one that they learned in a prior form of in the prior part of their life. And I think it's definitely worth trying.
Oh, this is wonderful news.
Thank
you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks, Susan. Bill in Madison has something for us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wanted to make a quick comment. We've had a household of 3 to 5 female cats for over 20 years. And I think the one thing we found more than anything, it's just having lots of litter box space.
Uh-huh.
If you have a lot of female cats, because even in our current structure, we have one that's sort of the odd man out a little bit, you know, and one of the other cats will gang up, you know, they'll like ambush out of the litter box, and
uh-huh.
That's been the only tricky bit that we've had to deal with lately. But the question I had was, we have one cat that likes to raise her hind legs when urinating.
An elevator butt. That's what I call these cats, yes.
Yeah, and, we've had her checked for a variety of things, and, you know, and outside of the occasional, you know, kind of normal issues of, you know, maybe, you know, some kind of something's clogged or, you know, or there's, you know, minor problems. It's, you know, there's nothing that stands out about this cat, really.
Yeah, yeah. We see this is a kind of one of those normal variations in urination postures that we'll see. Sometimes it's associated with kitties that don't like the litter that they're standing in, and they don't want to cozy up to it, whether it's the feel of it, the scent of it, because it's not cleaned enough, or whatever. And what I recommend doing for these cats is, instead of using a standard litter box that are, you know, usually the sides are 4 or 5 inches tall, go with one of the storage bins that are translucent, and you can cut actually a little square or rectangle out of one of the sides to allow the cat to go in, leave the lid off of it, and that way if the cat stands up, they're able to just hit the wall and it'll run back in.
Well, we've been going with a minimum height of 17 inches for quite a while.
Yeah, and so something like that. What I did for one of my cats that had the same problem, a boy cat, was I put like a shower curtain in it where I just tacked up on the wall a piece of vinyl that was draped into the litter box, and so that when he would back up, it would hit the shower curtain and run into the litter box, and it saved me a lot of problems with having to clean up stale urine that had soaked in under the box. So hopefully, you know, just doing something like that will work. work. But you're right. I mean, I think the big thing when you've got five cats is looking at how you can increase resources and space. And because most people can't afford to move to a new home that's bigger, think vertical, like adding in different cat trees, resting areas.
They all need a place to call home.
Yeah, lots of litter boxes in different locations where they're not going to be in a trapped situation, where they have a good escape potential. They can see that bully approaching them, so they can get, you know, hurry up and get things done and get out of there before they get attacked. And that's the problem with covered boxes in many of these cases.
Yep, there we go. Yep, thanks, Bill. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Donna in Hudson up next. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I live on a farm, and we, throughout the history since we've been here, we have cats sometimes and sometimes we don't, and for a while there we had none. But thanks to passersby or whoever, but we got a couple donated to us, and when we got them, they were already adult cats, fairly friendly, but yet they didn't like to be picked up a lot at any rate. They're just barn cats, and it wasn't too long after one of them was pregnant, had a litter. Pretty soon the other one was, had a litter. Long story short, we have now have upwards of 20 cats.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And first of all, it's crazy. I don't want this many cats, and we can't hardly keep food in the house for them. And secondly, then there's one from a litter last year who seems like a sweet cat, but everybody picks on her. They're just terrible. They're just mean. And so my question is twofold. What can I do with all these wonderful kitties, but some of them aren't hardly approachable by humans? And secondly, what do I do for the one that's being picked on so terribly?
Yeah, this is a case where you may want to contact a group. Like in the Madison area, we have a rescue group called Friends of Ferals that will help you with coming up with whether it's live trapping, getting them spayed and neutered. And, you know, you just kind of go through the group and keep catching them. And so that the population is going to be kept under control and not continuing to grow. This little cat that is being picked on by the group, again, whether it's because she's smaller, can't get up and get away, whether she is just acting as the victim, which just eggs the bully or bullying cats on because she sees them and may, you know, just start to run and they're like, great, we can chase her now. She may actually work out better if you do get her trapped in another outdoor situation. If she's not, you know, well socialized with other people, they would hopefully, if you have the same type of group that we have here in the Madison area, be able to place them in another farm situation, obviously in a spayed state so that she's not able to reproduce herself. And that's really, I think, you know, just being you owning the property, it's your responsibility to you know, cut down on these numbers. And the only way to do that is through birth control.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks. Good luck. Thank you so much, Donna, for calling. Judy in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Judy.
Yes, hello. Sandy, I'd like to, I want to know how many treats are too many. My 8-year-old Maine Coon eats her cat food very well, but she's a very skittish cat, yet she's very vocal about treats. She'll just stand where she knows where they are and demands them.
She has got you taught very well, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So I look at 10% of their diet. If more than 10% of their diet consists of treats, it's not going to be a balanced diet. And you may want to consider, if she really enjoys treats that much, getting them and putting them in one of these like treat dispensers that they make for cats.
I tried that. She's not interested.
Okay. Yeah. It's, you know, you have, sometimes you have to play and find the right one to help you so that she, you know, has something that she's not going to be bugging you. She'll just go and rattle this thing around and hopefully get a treat out of it. So, you know, don't give up if you just tried one form. There's lots of different ones out there. But about 10% is, and anything more than that, then we've got an unbalanced diet. So you have to kind of do the math when you're looking at calories and things. And it's by law now, all pet foods, including treats, should have the calories on the package. And your veterinarian veterinarian can do a body condition scoring on your cat to make sure that it is, you know, at the right body weight and be able to figure out how many calories a day your cat needs. And then we can convert that into this is how much food your cat should get. And these are the extras where you can use it for treats that your cat can have. And that's it may take doing a little bit of math that way, but I'm sure your veterinarian would be very capable of being able to do that for you.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling.
Thanks.
Yes, appreciate the call. And Elsa, we turn to you next in Appleton. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a finicky little cat. She's always been small, but she's lost weight recently due to our moving or selling the house. She's only like 5 pounds right now. But the big issue I have right now is she gets sick when our dog goes away. She vomits and she has diarrhea when the dog goes away. And my dog goes away a couple times a year because she's a foster dog at a breeder's.
Huh. This sounds like it could be stress related.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. You've kind of caught me off guard here because I've not heard this as a big issue before. For the most part, many cats are like, yay, the dog's gone. I've got the house back to myself. But if they're really bonded together, maybe having things that smell like the dog, like have a dog jacket or a T-shirt that the dog has worn, a dog bed that the cat can be able to sleep in, that type of thing may be very helpful. Really try to make sure that even though the dog's gone, your cat may be queuing into the dog's schedule. And, if you're, taking the dog for a walk or certain times of the day or when the dog gets fed or gets treats, sometimes cats just kind of join in on that. Try to stay with the same schedule, regardless of whether the dog is there or not. I think that the fact that she is so tiny, vomiting and diarrhea, I've seen some cases of stress-related colitis, but usually not vomiting. So, getting her checked out to make sure that there isn't anything physically wrong with her, I think would be a really good place to start as well.
Okay. I was wondering, too, if the stress was causing some bacteria in her gut to like bloom and make her sick when the dog is gone.
It's very possible. It's possible. It's very possible.
Okay.
Yeah. Or it may just be that if she's, not eating well, that could be, causing her some GI upset too. It's like, which came first? But getting her checked out to make sure there's nothing physically wrong with her is a good starting point.
There you go.
All righty. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Lisa in Madison. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I was just wondering how does Bravecto work on the skin of a dog, and what is Janus kinase inhibitor in Apoquel? How does that work?
Oh, boy, you are asking me to become a pharmacologist here, aren't you? Bravecto is one of the oral flea and tick products that are on the market. There are three of them on the market right now, Simparica, NexGard, and Bravecto. Bravecto is the one that is labeled for lasting for 3 months. It is given orally. As all products, the flea and tick, they have to bite, but they die very, very quickly. You're not going to have them feeding for an extended period of time. They die very, very quickly. So that's how they work, by being in the dog system exactly the chemical way. I can tell you after the break because I can look it up, but I don't know. All I know is that it's very, very safe, extremely effective, and people that have switched over from the topical flea and tick treatments to the oral are generally very, very happy because their pets like them better. A lot of pets don't like having that oily material put on their back. They want to roll and get it off of them. Or people just don't like touching them and seeing that on them either. So I think if you're using Bravecto and you're liking it, stay with it. A very safe product to use. Apoquel is the not so new. It's been on the market now for, probably about 2.5 years. It was in very short supply initially, but now it's in better supply. And it's an anti-itch medication. And you're right. It is what's called a JAK kinase inhibitor. Receptors, the itch receptors that are in the skin, are affected by this particular drug. And so it stops the sensation of itch. It's not going to get rid of allergies. It's not going to help with infections or stop the itch from infection, but it will stop the itch from dogs with allergies where they just are uncomfortable, causing trauma to their skin with secondary infections. And again, appears to be a very safe product to use. And I know that our oncology department has had, you know, a couple of cases where they're like, I don't know if we want to put this dog that's had cancer on that particular drug. I don't really know why, generally it's one of those drugs that we use that we feel that the benefit far outweighs any, even the minute risk that there may be a problem down the road.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. On our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, Deborah sent a nice photo of Colby and Jack.
Oh, I just got it. They're both like kind of reddish-orange kitties, and so, you know.
Litter mates.
Yeah, named after cheese, Colby Jack, yeah.
Oh, all right. You had to explain it to me.
Yes, yeah.
Well, it's a cute picture, that's for sure. Arlene in Round Lake, Round Lake Beach, Illinois, up next. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was calling because I have three cats who have chronic urinary infection, and they've been on a science diet medication. I'm sorry. Food. Mm-hmm. And I have not noticed any change, so I decided to try a raw diet.
Okay.
The raw diet really hasn't helped with the urinary infections, but it has helped with their weight. They've lost some fat, mm-hmm. so they're as heavy as they used to be. I need to know, how do I stop this cycle of continuous urinary infections between three cats?
This sounds really strange to me, because actually urinary tract infections, where we can culture a bacteria out of the urine, is quite an uncommon problem in cats. When we do see it, they're usually cats that are over 10 that often have some underlying issue affecting their ability to concentrate their urine. Young cats have such concentrated urine that bacteria just can't grow in it unless there's something physically wrong with the bladder itself. And so when we see cats under 10 years of age that have blood in their urine, the things that we get concerned about are either a bladder wall inflammation that we call fluted, feline lower urinary tract disease. It's sometimes referred to as sterile cystitis, where no bacteria grows. It's the bladder is the cat's stress organ, and when they are stressed, they will maybe start producing urine that has some blood, and they may get obstructed, unfortunately, if they've got enough cells and so on, but you don't grow any bacteria in it. And then the other thing would be a bladder stone, actually a stone living in the bladder, rolling around in there, causing enough irritation that now you're seeing blood in the urine. And again, you may not culture anything from that urine. So the big question is, have you had your cat's urine checked and cultured where they've actually grown a bacteria and your cat's been on an appropriate antibiotic?
They've had their urine checked, and they notice an infection. A few times crystals, not as many crystals now with the new food that I'm giving them.
Okay.
Have an infection. I don't think they've cultured it.
Okay, because that's,
they are on medication.
Yeah, but cats, this is the kind of one of my like pet peeves is that if you get a cat in that has maybe this sterile cystitis and you get a urine sample from them, there's going to be red blood cells in there. It's going to look like it's infected, but when you culture it, you don't grow anything. And so it's very important that if they have one of these episodes, that you actually get the urine cultured. So they grow it out and say, yes, there's bacteria there, or no, there isn't. Because these episodes typically last for about 5 to 7 days. How long do you put them on antibiotics? Usually a week, and then they get better. Is it the antibiotics making them better, or is it just tincture of time making them better? So that's where you really have to jump in and say, let's do some more diagnostic work. The fact that you're seeing crystals, again, the dilemma with that is cats produce such concentrated urine. If you take a urine sample, maybe collect it at home, or maybe your veterinarian collects it, and it sits on the counter and for any length of time, crystals will start to come out of solution. And so you have to look at a cat's urine sample hot out of the bladder. And if it isn't, if it's sat for any length of time, especially if it's been in the refrigerator, there's going to be crystals in there, even in a normal cat. So I don't trust whether there's crystals or not. I want to look at the whole big picture and see. And so maybe you consider getting x-rays done of your cat's bladders to see, do they have a bladder stone? Look into getting maybe an ultrasound done to see if they look, you know, the bladder wall looks okay. Get a urine sample, look at it hot off the press, and also get it cultured. I call it the urinary extravaganza. It's unfortunate that you have to go through that, but I really think the odds of you having three cats with bladder infections, bacteria living there, boy, you need to go to Vegas because it would be very rare to see that.
Yeah.
And it's constant. I mean, I have two girls urinating outside of the box.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, looking at litter box hygiene, do you have enough litter boxes for your cats? Are they cleaned enough? Are they in the right location? The right type of litter, the right size of box, you know, so when we've got a cat that's not using the litter box, yes, we always want to rule out a medical problem, but you also want to approach it from the behavior standpoint as well. And that would be something we're going in with a floor plan of your home with where the litter boxes are located, where the accidents are occurring, your, you know, litter box hygiene protocol, how often you scoop and wash and clean, the type of litter you're using, the dimensions of your litter boxes. That's all information that if you were to come and see me, I would want to be able to help you and your cats.
Oh, there we go. Well, good luck, Arlene.
I know. It sounds like, what a nightmare.
Oh, yeah for sure.
Especially with three of them. Yeah.
Get that culture done, though.
I know. The culture, I think, it's well worth the money just to say, yeah, my cats don't have an infection.
Yeah. Thanks again for calling, Arlene. Let's turn to Bob in Eau Claire next. Bob, hi.
Good morning, guys. Sandy, I always love hearing you talking about pets, and you're always so informative, and you give wonderful explanations.
Thank you very much.
Joy listening to you.
Thank you.
And I should say Dr. Sandy, I'm sorry.
That's okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, at any rate, Facebook, I just got an alert yesterday about a sweetener called Xylitol, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I did was I went to Snopes. To see whether or not the allegation is true, because it said some really dire things about what it can do to a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Their blood sugars and then
right.
It can actually destroy their liver.
Right, right.
Snopes said absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
And so the first thing I did this morning was to call the makers of Jif peanut butter and ask them, do you use xylitol in your product? And they said no.
Yeah.
Not. And if they were, they would label it.
Yeah.
It would be right out there front and center so you could see it.
Right. And so, xylitol is in a lot of products that humans ingest. One of the last cases I saw in that was a xylitol toxicity dog, and thank goodness the owners saw this, was the dog just ate a part of a pack of sugarless gum that had xylitol in it. It had gotten into the owner's purse and had taken it out and chewed it and eaten it, and the dog came in with a blood sugar. It was down around 30, not to the point where it was going to start seizuring, but very close. And with, you know, treatment through our critical care unit, the dog was able to turn around and be back to normal. And so we really have to pay attention to what we keep in our house. Things like the chewable vitamins that kids eat have xylitol in them. Some peanut butters do, because xylitol has a, I believe, like a low glycemic index, and so people that have to be on like low sugar diets will like to use products that have that in it. There are some dental products that are used for people that contain xylitol, different rinses and things like that as well. And so you really have to be a label reader for owning a dog or cat, because, you know, even like in the cat, from a cat's point of view, things like Asiatic lilies. I was down at our farmer's market in Janesville where I live, and beautiful bouquets of flowers. And I'm looking at them, I'm going, wait a minute, there's some lilies in here that even the pollen on them, if my cats were to brush up against them and groom them, would be toxic for them and put them into kidney failure. So I'm so glad that you're following up on this, and thank you for bringing it up. But xylitol is just one of many things out there that we have to be careful about.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Bob, very much for calling. Sue in Pulaski has something for us. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. My little 10-pound dog has horrible allergies. We've spent a couple years with a special vet here in the Green Bay area and a holistic vet. And she's been on Atopica. She's on the new one that you had just mentioned to the
Apoquil. Apoquil.
Yes, and I'm getting one from the pharmacy for her also, and I'm in the car. I don't remember the name. And the treatment she's been having was Biocom. And there's been no improvement, and she's just so pathetic. We can't grow hair. She's itching. I don't know if we should take her off, wean her off of everything and these couple medicines and start from scratch.
I think you probably look at getting a second opinion. Other things that can cause dogs to be really itchy besides allergies are things like scabies and other skin parasites, skin infections, especially yeast infections, which can be chronic and present with hair loss and skin thickening, and get mistaken for allergies when it is a yeast infection. And it's the old, which came first? Did the allergies start the yeast infection, or did the yeast infection, you know, start causing the itch? So I think you need to go back to kind of square one, because if your dog is not responding to Apoquil or the cyclosporine treatment that you mentioned, then there's something else going on that really needs to be investigated. And if you've not seen a veterinary dermatologist, that would be my first step, is get in to see not a holistic vet, but a veterinary dermatologist.
Oh, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Well, our guest today is Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a clinical instructor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our lines are all filled at 800-642-1234, but we'll just turn right back to the phones, and let's go to Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Sandy, I would like the name of and the source of the miracle drug that calmed your Brutus, the bulldog, with the thunder. We have so many thunderstorms, and I've got 68 pounds of hairy chow.
Oh, my goodness.
That he knows when they're coming.
Yep.
Half hour before.
Yep.
And like you said about not sleeping.
It does. It really does disrupt your life, doesn't it? My Brucie is a 10-and-a-half-year-old English bulldog who has a bark on him. And if there's any, like a thunderstorm in the middle of the night, boy, he starts barking and barking and barking. And what I have been using with him that I've had really good success with, and I would definitely recommend talking to your vet about trying it. It's a medication called Celio. It's spelled S S-N-O-P-E-S-I-L-E-O. It comes in a syringe that's an oral dosing syringe. And what it is a drug called transmucosal dexmedetomidine. And that's a big name for what this does. But it's a drug that we in the veterinary world have used as a sedation drug at much higher doses for a very long period of time. And this is at a very, very low level. And if you use it at the level that is recommended for the weight of your pet, you'll see very little sedation. The thing that I like about it is that I can give it even after he starts barking. And within a matter of 15, 20 minutes, he's calm and will sleep through the rest of the night without any troubles. That's the big issue with some of the other drugs that we use, is that they'll often override them and you have to give them before the thunderstorm. So in the past, I would have to be watching the weather. And if it looks like the weatherman saying, hey, there's a chance of a storm tonight, then I would have to medicate him. And then there isn't a storm. And meanwhile, he's had his Valium high all night and I gave him drugs that he didn't need. So that's one of the reasons why I like this, and that I can use it even after he's already started having some anxiety, and it does work. It's always best if you can give it beforehand as well, but that would be something. It's a prescription product, and you would have to get it through your veterinarian.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Happy nap to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate the call. Well, let's go to Joy in Prairie du Chien next. Hi, Joy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Falchuk, I really have a problem. I've got multiple dogs, as in sometimes I have two, but my sister and brother-in-law come along with their two, and so we have four, and we have multiple cats in our house, and we all have fleas.
Oh, boy.
And it started the beginning of July, and my dogs have always been medicated with Frontline. My cats have been medicated with Advantage, and it seemed to stop them or slow them down a bit, but now I'm beside myself because I've got two very big, hairy Samoyeds, and I don't want to shave them, but I've just got, they look like they've been rolled in cracked pepper.
Oh my goodness, that much. The fleas that you are seeing on your pet right now, or when you started seeing them in July, were from eggs that were laid 2 months previously. And so this is the problem that we see a lot of people get into, is they start medicating once they see a problem, but the problem has been there for a couple of months or more. And so when we have this many pets involved, it's important that they all get treated. You are going to see initially things are going to look worse after that first month because you're going to have this wave of eggs developing. And if you are doing flea surveillance on your dog, you're going to see it's not that the product's failing. If you're using something like Frontline, it's that there's more fleas hatching and jumping up on your pet, and you're seeing them before they die. But they are going to be dying before they can lay any eggs. So that would be, you've got to treat everybody. And that means that your visiting dogs need to be on flea and tick control. All the cats, I'd be looking at where these fleas could be coming from. A lot of times the source of the fleas for our household pets are from visiting nocturnal animals at night. When they've looked at raccoons, we know that about, 50% of raccoons carry the flea that affects our dogs and cats. About 70% of the possums that are nocturnal and coming into our yards carry the fleas that affect our dogs and cats. And then stray cats are also one of the big things too. And so when you see these like hot zones outside where your pet is actually bringing fleas into the house from these outdoor areas. And so getting rid of brush, setting live traps to get rid of any of these stray animals or wildlife that may be hanging around your yard. Vacuum your house like crazy, like really, really vacuum well, and throw the vacuum cleaner bag out, and then religiously treat the pets with a product that you would get from your veterinarian. And I'm not brand loyalist. Whether it is Frontline, whether it's Advantix, I don't know if I would use that on dogs when you have a household with cats, whether it's Vector 3D, but something that you are making sure that you've got the right dose for your dogs and cats, and they're on it at appropriate interval. Not all the spot-on products. I've had so many people say, yes, I'm using a product like Frontline. And then when they actually show it to me, they're using a cheap knockoff that they got at one of the big box stores. They may not be the same. So you have to know the product that you're using. If you are getting your Frontline through a veterinarian, all you have to do is show that you've bought it, show the receipt that, yes, everybody in the household is on it. Here's our receipt that we purchased it. If you're still seeing fleas with using it, their guarantee is that they will bring in an exterminator at no cost to you. But usually that isn't necessary. I mean, fleas are actually pretty easy to treat as long as you realize it's going to take you, if you're really religious about treating your pets, a minimum of 3 months of consecutive treatment to get them under control.
I don't know whether to shave my oldest, Sam is, well, he's 10 and a half, and he's got a full neutered coat. And he was just about to blow coat, so part of him is combed out and part of him is not. And I don't know whether to shave him down.
You shouldn't have to. If you're putting that front line on the skin in between the shoulder blades, parting the hair, getting it down to the skin so it's not just sitting on the hair, so making sure that you're applying it appropriately, you don't have to shave unless he needs to be shaved because he's so matted or anything. But that will get that product will actually get into the hair follicles and coat the hairs as they're coming up. So you do not have to shave.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Looks like a little bit of work ahead.
She's got a busy fall. Yes.
Pat in Iola next. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a 14-year-old Pomeranian. We only got her 6 years ago, so I haven't had her whole life. She began having intense coughing last week to the point of throwing up everything that she took in, including when she took in water. She would get her drink, and then she would throw it up. We, through research, have understood that it could be her heart, blastomycosis, heartworm. My question is, when we take her to the vet, if she's improved, she's not coughing to that point anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, she's again getting exercise without intense exercise tends to bring it on, but she's also learned that she can use the cough to get my attention.
Okay.
So it's sometimes hard to differentiate.
Uh-huh.
What tests are necessary to have? What treatments would be most viable?
Well, the fact that you did your research, your veterinarian, there's two things that Dr. Google can't do. One is a physical exam. And two is getting an adequate history from you. And so the first thing that if you do go to your veterinarian, they're going to be asking you questions about the nature of the cough, what triggers it, whether it's productive or not, meaning does she cough anything up? How long it's been going on and so on and so on. Are they on heartworm preventative? But they'll get a very thorough history. Then they're going to do a physical exam. And the physical exam is going to help rule out, do we have something like blasto? Because usually with that, they're going to have a fever. They're going to have open sores someplace on their body. Usually lymph nodes are going to be up. So there's going to be certain things on physical exam that they're going to find that may start heading them down that path. They'll listen to the chest. They'll see, is this heart disease or is it primarily a lung problem? Does the dog have a heart murmur? What are the pulses like? Is the dog in heart failure? So they'll palpate the trachea to see, do we have an issue with tracheitis, like a simple kennel cough that's just knocked your dog for a loop last week? So getting that thorough physical exam done is key to know where you're going to go next. Depending on what they find, they'll probably say, let's get a chest x-ray if they hear anything abnormal in the chest. If your dog has not been on heartworm preventative, they may say, let's get a heartworm test done on your dog. They may want to do some other blood work to see, do we have any inflammatory changes that would be consistent with an infection like something like blasto. Depending on what they see on that, then you can go even further. If there's masses in the chest, you may be able to do ultrasound-guided needle biopsies. If there's fluid in the chest, we may be able to drain some of that off and have a look at it. I mean, it's a step-by-step process. And I think the first thing is, rather than letting this elderly dog, a younger dog that develops a cough that's, even for a day or two, I get concerned about. But an older dog that has this a cough to that of severity that they're vomiting with it as well, that dog probably should have been at a vet clinic last week sometime. So, yeah. But there's no time like the present. So, you know, hang up, give your vet a call, and get them in today for a good physical exam.
And thanks very much for calling.
I
appreciate your call. Let's go to Jenny in Madison next. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I have a cat, a rescued cat, who at one time, I guess, had been near death with, you know, neglect from a farm. Nothing against farms, but
yep.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. He had developed a rash under his chin to the point that it was all scabs, and that was about a year or so after I got him, and that was in September. And then in October, he had more hair loss, and he was put on prednisolone.
Where else was he losing hair?
Under his chin.
Just under his chin was the only area? Okay.
Well, no, and then it continues. And then he had a big bald spot between his thighs that he was chomping on, and they did an aspirate on that, and it came back as inflammation allergic reaction. So back on pred. And so I can't pill him, so I have to put the pred on. It's a gel. I put it on inside his ear,
mm-hmm.
And so he's got pred on one ear and an antihistamine on the other. And he bounces back and forth from being on both twice a day, dropping down to once a day, and back and forth. So I do have an appointment at UW to see an allergist in September.
Uh-huh.
But I've been told that those tests are not really. I don't know. I don't want to say they're not reliable. It doesn't work well in cats. And we've tried getting his food down to just one protein, like all venison.
Uh-huh.
And really nothing's working. And I've tried him on a raw diet, but he won't eat raw.
Yeah. You know, when we have a cat that's barbering their hair coat, I think it's possible you may have two different things going on. You may have a cat with chin acne, which often is a bacterial yeast infection that will need medical management along those lines, either with antifungal or antibacterial medications. But when we see a cat that's barbering their belly, there's a really good Klein education sheet. If you go to online, there's a group called Veterinary Partners. And if you just Google fur mowing, like mowing your lawn, you'll get this article that will tell you about a cat, you know, just like how a veterinarian approaches these cases. Usually we're looking at doing fungal cultures, looking at parasitic management, so they need to be on flea control year-round, even if they're indoors, because even indoor cats, people can bring the odd flea in, and if they're flea allergic, that can trigger this. So on year-round flea control, doing some skin scrapings and hair plucks to look for a parasite that's called Demodex that cats can get that can cause intense itching. So I'd be looking for those as well. If we don't find them, sometimes we still just go through a round of treatment, which is usually lime sulfur dips for several weeks to see if that doesn't do the trick. We will often put them on a hypoallergenic diet, and typically that's going to be a hydrolyzed protein diet, so that it's a well-balanced diet, but it's going to contain no noticeable proteins that the cat's body is going to be able to detect. And so they break the proteins down into little itty-bitty bits, so the cat gets all the nutrition, but it's not going to cause an allergic reaction. A diet like that, when we're putting cats on a hypoallergenic diet as a food trial, you're looking at least about 3 months, 10 to 12 weeks of being on that diet, and only that diet, which means they're not outside hunting mice, they're not getting any treats, they're not getting any table food, and it can't be an over-the-counter diet because those may not be made in plants that are totally cleaned out, so you need to use a diet that you're going to be getting from your veterinarian. And so those are kind of the initial steps that we take. And then if we are, you know, considering that this cat maybe does have environmental allergies, allergy testing may be part of it. And that will help us find out what is your cat allergic to, what molds, what pollens, and so on. The medications that you're using as a transdermal gel, to my knowledge, I don't think that those two, antihistamines and steroids in a gel form, are that effective, whether they reach therapeutic levels or not. There are certain drugs drugs that do, but some of them just don't reach therapeutic levels. And I'd be really checking with the formulating pharmacy that you're getting these from to make sure that they, you know, the research has been done on those. Because I mean, boy, that would make life really easy for us if we could use prednisone or prednisolone, which is actually the drug that you should be using in your cat, prednisolone, in a gel form. I would be using it all the time in my patients that need to be on that if it worked in a gel form. But to my knowledge, it doesn't. So your cat may not be getting the medication that it actually needs.
All right. There you go. Things to look into, Jenny. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had something on Facebook from Ann, who just had tuned in and heard the end of a discussion on medicine for dogs during storms. And wondered the name of the product again.
The product that I'm using on my own dog is called Sileo, S-I-L-E-O. And it's dexmedetomidine transmucosal gel. And it is a prescription product. You'd have to get through your veterinarian.
What is it? Once more?
S, as in Sam, I-L-E-O.
Sileo.
Sileo.
All right. On to Jenny in Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I would like Dr. Sandy's views on declawing. We're considering getting a kitten for the household, but we do have a family member on warfarin, and I know that's not a good combination, so I kind of wanted to know what her views are on declawing.
Yeah, a couple things you may want to think about. Adopting an adult cat that may already be declawed would solve that problem. You don't have to make that decision. Plus, adult cats are probably going to be a little bit better than you kind of know their personality, so you're not going to have that risk of getting someone scratched. But if you've got your heart set on getting a kitten, a couple of things that I would be recommending that you try before you look into surgically altering your cat. One would be consider the soft paws, the little glue-on nails that nail caps that go on. But if, you know, and they're a pain to use because they yeah. fall off and you got to put them back on again. And, you know, I know that there's, you know, many people on one side of the fence and the other, some that are anti-declaw and some that aren't. And I kind of sit in the middle and I look at, in your situation, if you are going to be getting a kitten and you're living with somebody that is on a blood thinning agent that could potentially have some bleeding issues, I would be looking at having them declawed and, you know, teaching you how to trim the claws until they get to that point. And maybe you can get over that kittenhood stage. You don't have to do it. But if you do have to do it, make sure that you're doing it by, you know, probably laser declaw. They heal up a little bit faster or, you know, by an experienced veterinarian that's done lots of them so that it's, you know, it's quick and fast and they heal up quickly. That would be the way I'd be looking and making sure that they're also on pain medication postoperatively. Very important that they get on the appropriate amount of pain medication.
All right. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Dan in River Falls, thank you for calling. You have a question for us.
Yeah. Hi. Dr. Sawchuk's my favorite show of all Larry's good ones.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I have Beth and I have a Bernese Mountain Dog who's 7.5. And he's very healthy, and he always has been. About every other month, it's intermittent, he'll get, in distress, and he'll be kind of frantic and urging, and he won't eat grass, and he gags up, I guess it's bile, pancake-sized yellow puddle, mm-hmm. not to be, you know, indiscreet. But anyhow, it always goes away. I'm just wondering, is there something I can do? I hate to just watch him to lessen his discomfort when he's in this distress. This does not happen a lot.
Yeah.
He gets so frantic if he's not near grass, he'll try and eat the carpet.
But yeah, licking things up. Yeah, I had a basset that would do this, and I called it the erps because he would walk around and just make this erping sound and lick anything that he could get in his mouth. Likely, the fact that this is occurring very infrequently, it's always accompanied with vomiting up some bile. There's a condition that dogs get that's called bilious vomiting syndrome. Instead of like us, where we reflux and we get heartburn, dogs will reflux bile up into their stomach, and it is irritating, and they wake up. Usually you'll hear their stomach gurgling. It's often first thing in the morning or after they've had a prolonged fast. Maybe you're late getting home for giving them their dinner or something like that, where their stomach's been empty. That may cause it. A couple of things that you may want to try, if you can, just even using something like a turkey baster to get some like plain yogurt into your dog, anything that you can get them to swallow that's going to coat the stomach that may get things moving in the right direction, may make them feel a little bit better. Sometimes these dogs that do it frequently, just changing their feeding schedule so that they're eating something before they go to bed helps as well, because then they've got something that in their stomach that they can work on throughout the night, and that may help prevent some of it too. Some of these dogs have to go on drugs that are called prokinetic agents, but I don't know if that's something that your dog at this point is needing. So try the little bit of yogurt. I think that may hopefully work. Yeah.
And thanks a lot for calling. And Dr. Sandy, thank you so much. You will be back on September 27th.
I am, at the end of the month now. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on the 27th of September. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk with an author of a book about restoring an abandoned garden and about finding herself along the way. So I hope you can join us for that. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.